Good morning. I'm calling to order the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. We'll start with having the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Cassius-Watoon, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bonner. Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Heinzman.
I'm here.
Representative Morrison. Representative Pryor.
Here.
Representative Wasilick.
Present.
Representative West.
Okay, and I do believe that we have a quorum. We seem to be having a few problems pulling together the minutes of February 19th, so we're just we noticed a few typos as we looked at it this morning. Want to get that cleaned up. But the minutes of February 21st we will address, and so if I may have a motion to approve the minutes of February. Oh, with one technical correction. Pardon me, there actually is a technical correction on that as well, which is simply the amendments are styled HF and then the rest of the number, and in each of those amendments it actually is an H and then the rest of the numbers is what I'm being advised by the our committee legislative assistant. So, but with that technical correction, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
With that technical correction, Mr. Chair, I would move that. I'm just happy this committee has minutes. Thank you very much.
Representative Heinzman, thank you for that motion. Any further discussion on the minutes? And seeing none, all in favor of approval, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. We have achieved approval of the minutes for February 21st. Thank you, Representative Heinzman. So members, we are, as with other finance committees, going to be receiving an overview of the governor's budget proposal as our first item. A reminder that we will be seeing the proposal in the form of bill or bills. I think that that may still be being worked out with the revisor's office. But this is simply to give us an overview for our planning and our work as a committee. And so I'm first calling up the folks from the Department of Education to provide their background. Members, the early childhood pieces of each of these three proposals are small portions of the broader proposals. And so I've asked them just to highlight for us just the early childhood portions that would be in the jurisdiction of our committee. And so we'll do that and then move on to a couple bills and keep going. So if I can have the first testifier introduce yourself and identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bobby Burnham. I serve as Director of Early Learning Services at the Department of Education. Along with Caitlin and Sandy Myers, we're here to briefly go over the proposals in the governor's budget that relate to the work we do with the department around early learning. The first proposal is to maintain the funding for voluntary pre-kindergarten for 4,000 students in 140 schools across 80 school districts and charter schools that is set to currently expire. Additional proposals in the governor's budget is to allow districts to apply for funding and be notified if they receive the requested seats the school year before or prior to in order to allow for proper planning, facilities, upgrades, and develop partnerships. We've heard, we've received quite a bit of feedback from districts and charter schools that their budget time is really crunch time in January and it doesn't really fit well with the current application timeline for voluntary pre-K. So we're hoping to help them with their budgeting process by allowing them to know the number of seats they get the year prior to help with planning. We also want to continue to encourage mixed delivery partnerships by allowing child care centers, family child care programs licensed under Minnesota Statute 245.03 or a community-based organization to charge four-year-olds participating in the voluntary pre-K program as long as they did not receive funding for that child. This is to promote mixed delivery. Currently, especially in rural parts of the state, some districts are not able to fill classrooms with voluntary pre-K eligible children because you cannot charge. So this would allow districts to have a true classroom with blended and braiding children. So you might have six voluntary pre-K children in the classroom, as long as children, as well as children who are being funded through school readiness, ECSE. So it really opens up the ability to fill classrooms with children across multiple funding streams. Another proposal is to increase the Minnesota Department of Education's capacity to provide technical assistance and support program and fiscal oversight. Currently, the funding provides for one FTE, and this one FTE basically has the capacity to manage the application process. And given that voluntary pre-K is basically adding a new grade level to the K-12 system, there needs to be quite a bit more technical assistance around ensuring high quality programming, and we just do not currently have the capacity to provide that TA to really do what we feel is a good job at supporting districts in the implementation of this program.
Ms. Burnham, pardon me for interrupting. I want to make sure to direct members' attention to the sheet in your packet that says MDE proposals in early childhood. And I'm just wondering, your reference, Ms. Burnham, to the technical assistance point, is that referenced on this sheet or is that something in addition? I was just looking on it and just trying to follow along on what you're describing. I want to make sure we're all tracking.
Currently, it is not on that sheet. It is in the change item that was submitted, but we could certainly get you additional information on those bullet points.
No problem. Yeah. And if there's something, I just want to make sure we've got the full picture of each of those pieces. So, good. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple more bullet points for the voluntary pre-K proposal is to fund the further development of, at the Department of Education, we've been developing an early childhood data warehouse system. This warehouse system currently collects the federally required data from our early childhood special ed program. So districts are required to submit data to the department, and we are building off that system in order to collect better data from our voluntary pre-K programs. So currently in the statute, programs are required to measure impact of their voluntary pre-K program and use a age-appropriate version of our kindergarten entry profile assessments. So we needed to expand our ability to collect that data that we receive from districts and produce user-friendly reports back to districts to help them make better decisions about aligning instruction curriculum and their assessment. So we are building out this data warehouse across the division with multiple funding streams. But we really see this as an avenue to collect better data to be able to see the impact of the voluntary pre-K program. And then the last proposal bullet point is to separate Minneapolis and St. Paul school districts. And we currently have four buckets that the voluntary pre-K money is divided among, and now we are proposing that Minneapolis and St. Paul, due to their size, have their own bucket. And with that, we'll go into the Early Learning Scholarship Special Revenue Fund.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandy Myers, and I am a supervisor with the Early Learning Services Division at the Department of Education, and I oversee the Early Learning Scholarship Program. So this part of the governor's proposal is recommending that the appropriation that's for early learning scholarships actually sits into or transfers into a special revenue account to ensure that funds can fully be spent on childcare and early learning scholarships as it was intended. Because our area administrators must forecast and predict approximately how much a child might need, even though there's ranges based on the parent-aware rating the program chooses, early learning scholarships can be blended and braided with other funding streams, so therefore they often underestimate how much one child might need and overestimate how much another child may need. And over the last two bienniums, this has resulted, even though they've appropriated in excess of the amount of money available for early learning scholarships, the actual expenditure has been underspent. And by being able to utilize this, the excess funds that otherwise would cancel into a transfer into a special revenue account, we estimate just by the last two bienniums, approximately additional 1,000 children in a biennium may be eligible to be served with a scholarship with the same amount of money that was originally appropriated. The way scholarships works is once a child has a scholarship, they have up to 12 months to use it. We also have try to time the billing cycle if they are using other funding sources, such as child care assistance. And so it may take up to 3 months also to correct. That's another reason why funds sometimes cancel, is we don't know at the time that the scholarship was awarded what they will receive. So because of these specific conditions, that's why this has been recommended as part of the governor's budget.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next proposal in the governor's budget is related to Head Start background studies. So the governor recommends that the statutory authority be given to the Minnesota Department of Human Services to add Head Start programs that are license exempt and not receiving child care assistance funds, as well as tribal Head Start programs, to the list of programs that can contract with DHS to use the DHS background study system. Currently, only DHS licensed Head Start and other individuals working in licensed early childhood programs are able to access the DHS system, and Head Start programs must fully implement this new federally required background study check process no later than September 30th, 1990. So it's streamlining the process. DHS currently holds the system, and so we are asking that all Head Start and tribal programs are able to use that system at DHS instead of MDE, because we manage the Head Start program, creating our own system. We just want to partner with DHS to streamline the background studies for other Head Start programs.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, Caitlin Snyder, Department of Education. The last item that the governor is recommending in education is correcting an accounting error in the kindergarten students with disability calculation. We've mentioned briefly in this committee before that how there are different hours requirements for different pupil units. So there's different hours required in kindergarten versus high school, for example. Before all day K was passed, the state funded up to 0.6, I believe, of a kindergarten unit. Of a kindergarten pupil. They did provide full funding for a kindergarten student with disabilities, however. That level of hours was set at 875, and then when All Day K was passed in 2013, that hour requirement was set at 850. So the requirement for our kindergarten students with a disability is slightly higher than our kindergarten students without a disability. The larger concern in this area is that the way that the statute currently reads, kindergarten students with a disability are not allowed to generate extended time revenue. So this allows a student to generate up to 1.2 of whatever their funding level is for extended time services, usually before or after the school day. So our kindergarten students with special needs are not able to generate revenue in the same way that our kindergarten students without special needs. This was just an error, an inadvertent error in 2013 when All Day K was passed. So we would like to correct this.
Okay. Does that conclude your presentation on the MDE proposals? Yes. Okay. So any questions on those proposals? And then we'll, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Snyder, I'm just, what do you mean an error? How does that? That seems like a mistake more than an error. Is it? Can you explain what you mean by that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, this is something that should have been caught in 2013 when the state passed all-day kindergarten. The nature of the Capitol is that sometimes these bills are getting written at very late hours, and this just wasn't caught at the time.
Okay.
It's a very small fiscal cost of the state, about $100,000 ongoing, and hopefully this year we can see this corrected.
I should also probably note that given this is kindergarten, it probably will be in the province of the Education Finance Committee rather than ours as well. But Representative Feinsman, anything else? No, that's all okay. Any other questions regarding the proposals from MDE? And seeing none, thank you very much. And I believe it's Department of Human Services we have next, and in fact it's Health. Okay. Pardon me. I was looking for my own agenda to see. And please introduce yourself. I believe that there may be a presentation from the department. Okay, we're getting that set up. Please introduce yourself and begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joan Brandt. I'm the Division Director for Child and Family Health at the Department of Health.
And Ms. Brandt, I might ask if you can adjust the microphone, just make sure you're picked up fully. Thank you.
Is that better?
It certainly is.
Thank you. So I'm here to talk a little bit about the Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development Fund that is in the governor's budget. These grants will support the cultural and community strengths of communities of color and American Indian communities, and developing strategies that promote early childhood and family health and development. It's part one of the One Minnesota Vision Community Prosperity. The rationale for this funding is that we know that many state and local programs that are intended to support pregnant and parenting families do not address the specific needs of families of color and American Indian families. Nor do these programs always support the specific needs of families in greater Minnesota or families living with income instability. According to the Risk, Reach, and Resilience Report recently released by the Wilder Foundation, decades-long practices and policies that contribute to institutional and structural racism and other inequities are linked to the economic, health, and family stability risk factors described in this report. Because of these inequities, stubborn racial, ethnic, and economic disparities have developed over time within our indicators for early learning, health and well-being, economic security and safety, stability and nurturance. The cumulative risk may cause toxic stress and have a compounding effect throughout life, which then negatively affects children's brain development, learning ability, lifelong health, and well-being. While no single risk factor determines a child's developmental trajectory, cumulative risk, as described in the Wilder report, is the most predictive of adverse outcomes in childhood and across the lifespan. Often many of the strategies implemented to help children of color and American Indian children do not leverage the existing community and family strengths, which is really the intent of these community grants. It underutilizes many of the assets the communities already possess. Supporting health and development, early learning, economic stability, and safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environments, as the communities define themselves, at home, at school, and in community systems, are the top priorities to promote healthy development and well-being for young children and their families. This grant program lifts up community-centered solutions as a key driver in mitigating and eliminating the inequities that may lead to disparate child and family outcomes. So the intent of the grant is really to build on cultural and community strengths. The actions that we've taken over the past decade to mitigate racial, geographic, and economic disparities have not had a significant effect. Supporting community strengths and building upon those strengths to support healthy early development is a strategy that communities of color and American Indian communities have been requesting over multiple years. If we don't do this, it is possible that the disparities in outcomes, which are the worst in the nation, will continue or get worse. If we do fund this, then the same disparities could potentially improve over time. We know that Minnesota is home to roughly about 423,000 children under the age of six, of which about 30% are children of color or American Indian children. And we know that of the 30%, 69% live in moderate to high and high composite risk counties, which are identified in the Wilder report. So our intent would be to fund communities. Initially, what we would do is convene an advisory group that would work with the department to define the indicators that would be important to be trying to address that would assist in developing the RFP and choosing communities that need to, that would receive the funding. We would work, our division would work in cooperation with the Center for Health Equity at the department to work with this advisory committee to provide administrative processes, technical assistance, evaluation, and to define the metrics. And ultimately, we would hope that this would reduce racial, geographic, and economic disparities within health and developmental outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Brandt about the proposal? I'll maybe just ask one clarifying question. I see that there's the reference to young children prenatal to age 8. My understanding is that, at least as I've heard of Community Solutions Fund along the way, there'd be a particular focus or priority given to programs that are focusing on the youngest children in that age range, which is one of the reasons I think it would be presented here. Can you just confirm that or just clarify?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any other questions then? And seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Brandt. And we'll move on to our presentation from the Third Department, Department of Human Services, to give us an overview of the governor's proposal there. And we have slides for this presentation as well. Please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Good morning. I am Lori Posing with the Department of Human Services and the Child Care Assistance Program. And in the governor's budget, we are investing in the Child Care Assistance Program by making improvements, including rates and addressing the waiting list and then some program integrity items. So I will give a brief overview. This committee has heard this before, but we serve about 30,000 children a month, and 60% of those are age 5 and younger. The federal compliance issues that remain with the Child Care Development Fund requirements make improvements to the CCAP program to make it more seamless and family-friendly. And usable for families as well as supporting the providers who serve children. So some items we need to complete our federal compliance under 12-month eliginability include eliminating a 6-month limit on portability pool, because this happens when a family moves from one county to another and that county has a waiting list that lasts longer than 6 months. And then families also right now who receive MFIP for only 1 month might end up also in the same situation where they would go on a waiting list instead of being served. And then we have a small group of children who might get served till through their age 13. And right now CCAP ends upon turning 13, and that's out of compliance with federal law because they need to finish their 12 months if needed. So those are the 12-month eligibility items. We also would like to make improvements that better serve homeless families. And by that, we mean an expedited application process. So families would hear within 5 days, and they would have some time to submit their verifications. And then we would specifically waive activity requirements for 3 months to allow families to have some time to do job search, gather their again, documentation, and do the things that they need to become more ready for the job market. We have some other small improvements that overall just, again, do the federal compliance items and also ensure health and safety for all of Minnesota's children who use CCAP by making sure that out-of-state providers meet the same health and safety requirements that are required now under Minnesota. So that's just, you know, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin. We have a few providers on the border cities where we just need to make it clear in the law that we can enforce the same requirements that those states are probably also enforcing. So, and then due process for providers. The reason we want to do this is that all providers don't have appeal rights or a fair hearing process or a way to dispute a difference in opinion or an action that occurred that might negatively affect them. And so we propose a fair hearing process or an administrative review, depending on what the reason is of what they're disputing. And in order to do that, we would it would require two FTEs in the appeals division of DHS. And then the rates, I know we talked about this a few weeks ago, updating maximum rates to at least the 25th percentile is the minimum federal requirement. We need to change the rate survey, or I'm sorry, right now we do a survey every 2 years to survey rates in the market, but we don't update the rates. They haven't been updated since 2014. The language in this bill would both raise the rates to the minimum of the 25th percentile and then change the frequency of the rate updates and set that in law so that we are doing the survey every 3 years and then tying increases to the survey. The payments go to about 3,300 providers in a given month right now. As I mentioned, and this is a little bit new information from the last time we talked about rates, which was states do need to increase their payment rates to the 25th percentile by 9/30/2019 to avoid a penalty. That is new direction that was more specific than in past, where there was more vague about what's the lowest a state can be at. So we are our waiver for this has expired. We are under corrective action, and we are expected to raise the rates to the minimum of the 25th percentile. There's also something in the budget about registration fees. It's a small cost item, but we also intend to align registration fees so that those are also more aligned with the market. And we've also tried to explain our complicated rate structure by talking about how many rates do we fully cover in our current rate structure based on the newest information we have about prices and costs charged by providers. We're covering only 16% of family child care prices and 23% of the state's center prices. This is just a graphic of that same, showing how in 2006 we were covering close to 70% of family child care's rates and just under 60% of the center rates, and we have clearly lost ground on that. The governor also proposes to serve families on the waiting list. There were just about 2,000 families in December. 25 counties had waiting lists. With this funding, we would serve about 1,000 families. Typically, when a county releases applications, it's about a 50% success rate, if you will, reaching families. They may have thought they were eligible and might not be. They might not be ready yet to apply for child care assistance. So, based on that, we estimate serving about 1,000 families or 2,000 children. And then we have a program integrity proposal that will enhance our ability to enforce the attendance record keeping requirements and just make it clear that it is a requirement and that it would be an overpayment if those attendance records are not kept properly. Also clarifying that absent day and holiday billing needs to be distinguished as that so that days are tracked correctly and, again, could be charged as an overpayment when it's not done correctly. This specifically allows also a penalty for providers who fail to report decreases in attendance. It's been a requirement that providers report when a child attends less than 50% of the time in a four-week period, but we really haven't had any teeth behind that, and so this would clearly allow a penalty to be applied if that does not occur. And then where there's savings in the program is limiting retroactive eligibility for families for 3 months. Right now, when a family applies on MFIP, they might request child care 6 months retroactively, and this would limit that to 3 months, which aligns with medical programs. And also, we've worked with counties and tribes and talked about, is 3 months the correct time to allow for a family to meet with their employment counselor, get their paperwork done, get maybe their provider approved if their provider hasn't participated before, and 3 months is sufficient to meet that time frame. So that is the package of proposals that are directly tied to the child care assistance program.
And the sum total of the early childhood proposals, I gather, from the department. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for providing the overview of the department's proposals. And a reminder to members that we're going to be hearing these in the form of a bill or bills, so be able to get into that when we do. So questions from several members. So first, Representative Franson, and then Representative Heitzman. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. Mm-hmm. So the governor's CCAP integrity anticipates about $2 million in savings in the next biennium and then $2.5 million in the following biennium. Does the governor believe that there's only about $1 million in fraud each year?
Ms. Posehn, if you're able to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know what the governor believes about the number of fraud, but I will say that there are other program integrity proposals that sit within the OIG, and so that's a different part of the budget.
Okay, because that is a huge part of the discussion this year, too. The OLA will be sometime releasing his report on that. Is it the department's intention to wait until that report is released before maybe perhaps some more ideas from the department come forward on that particular topic?
Ms. Posehn.
That's partially correct. Like as I said, the OIG is, Mr. Chair, Representative, the OIG is proposing some expansion of their investigative capabilities, but we are also awaiting the report and have some additional ideas ready to go and are intending that they will align with recommendations of the report.
And before I go back to Representative Franson, I just want to clarify, though, so there is a separate set of proposals, you're saying, from OIG. I guess if you can have them sent, because I would consider that as part of what we want to be seeing, just to understand the budget proposal. Sounds like that piece we may not have in front of us. So if you can make sure to get that to us. And then Representative Franson.
Thank you. Speaking about the OIG, how does the governor plan on changing the toxic work environment within that department? You're probably wondering, what do you mean by toxic work environment? Well, the OIG has been doing some stellar work on the fraud, yet under the quote-unquote leadership of the OIG Inspector Carolyn Hamm, these same investigators are being investigated by an asset management firm called PFM, undermining, in my opinion, the work that they are doing uncovering the fraud and being punished for bringing this fraud to the public, in essence basically being punished for being a whistleblower.
I think there's a question in there. So, and it looks like Ms. Sommerfeld is going to answer. If you can identify yourself and then provide any response or thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jennifer Sommerfeld. I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. We are not here today, Representative Franzen, to talk about the OIG's proposals. We are simply here and prepared today to talk about the CCAP budget pieces. So I think we can get back to you or have a greater conversation after the hearing about OIG issues and probably involve folks from OIG if that would be.
And, Representative Franson, and we do have in front of us, this is that set of proposals, and then I was asking about the others. So Representative Franson.
Sure. Well, I like to have things on the record when things are said off the record. Sometimes then the public doesn't get an update on what's being told. So There's four additional investigators for medical assistance fraud in the governor's budget as well. What is the anticipation for how many investigators will be hired to focus on the child care assistance program fraud?
If you're, Ms. Somerville, if you're aware of the specifics of the governor's proposal that relate to early childhood and relate to CCAP, then please provide that. If you don't have that information that, at this time, then we'd want to get that. But please, Ms. Somerville.
Mr. Chair, Representative Franzen, I don't have the OIG proposal here today with me, and so we work on the CCAP portion of things and the CCAP program integrity piece. It would require that staff from OIG present more detail on their budget.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you. Well, I would say that the CCAP program in the OIG is kind of intertwined, so that's why I'm asking these questions. I guess I wasn't expecting for the OIG to be in a separate bucket and off the table for today, but thank you.
And Representative Franzen, to clarify, so I'd ask the departments to provide budget overview for areas they've retained our committee. I think you could tell from my question that I was actually expecting that all that the pieces would be included. It sounds like organizationally, if I'm understanding them right, sort of the budget pieces just happen to be in separate buckets, and it sounds like we didn't get that bucket. So, but I'd be happy to make sure that we get a piece on that. And maybe we want to do it in the overview form, Representative Franzen, or maybe that we just, at that point, we got a bill, and then let's just get it in the form of a bill. But we absolutely should hear those proposals and have a full discussion on them. Absolutely. Representative Feinsman.
I appreciate hearing that, Mr. Chair. And just before I start in, do you have a time frame, an idea when we might start having that opportunity? I don't.
Representative Feinsman, whenever I've asked the, so I think that the departments have 10, there's some number of days from when the proposals are announced to have them convert into bill language. And I may be looking for our fiscal staff or otherwise, or it may be that Ms. Somerville knows when the bills are anticipated to be created into language. So I'm looking to see if anybody can help us, because I would certainly anticipate, Representative Heinzman, that we should be getting the bill language very soon.
Well, just to be clear, need to. I mean, specifically in regard to these questions, in the investigators that may be up being applied to this issue. I don't know about you, but my email, my phone is burning to the ground on this thing. And if this committee doesn't work on this issue, there's going to be a lot of angry people.
And Representative Heinzman, to confirm, I was actually expecting to get the full budget overview from each of the pieces today.
So
yeah, no, I'm actually surprised. There's been a lot going on not to have that. So certainly expecting to be getting that as part of the budget proposal. Again, we can... what we can do is pull that back in that form, or it may be that we get the bills quickly enough that then we can just do it in the form of a bill rather than needing to do this, because then at that point we can actually have that, you know, the testimony again on a bill, et cetera, et cetera. So we can take a look at that and see. We may want to do it in the overview form, or we might want to just get it in a bill and get it that way. But either way, yeah, absolutely, we should. So anything further, Representative Heinzman?
Yeah, I'm gonna probably still ask a few questions if it's okay.
No, of course.
Chair,
yeah, no,
I'm
please.
I'm gonna start with a slide, and I don't see the slide. Oh, there it is, number 5. If it's okay, there's a percent of provider prices fully covered by CCAP standard maximum rate, and I see that the information starts at 2006 and brings us to 2018, and your comment was, if I'm remembering correctly, if I wrote it down correctly, is clearly we're losing ground in terms of the amount of money that's available or maybe covering those costs at that level for these kids. And I don't know how to ask for this except to just kind of put it out there. Is there a way to look at the regulatory climate in 2006 as opposed to 2018, or maybe the economic climate as it relates to the regulatory climate, to get a little bit better breakdown? As I'm talking to my providers and I'm hearing some of the same things that Representative Franzen has been talking about on a number of occasions and the difficulties that my providers are facing, as a small business guy, I know my costs go up when I have a different regulatory climate, when I have more expectations from the state. It would be nice to better understand why the coverage no longer extends as far as it did in 2006. And maybe you could put some more light on that. You probably have information at hand, but I could easily assume that there's other things yeah, play, and regulations could be a part of that.
Ms. Posehn or Ms. Sommerfeld, can you shed some light into why that such a steep drop over those 12 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, in order to assess what portion of a provider's budget is tied to regulatory requirements, I mean, that would be beyond the scope of what a rate survey would gather.
And I just wonder if somebody else, and Representative Lisa, I'll offer this out to you, it's your question, but there may be somebody from the department or otherwise, they can help shed light into why such a steep plunge from 65% to 17% in that number of years. But I'll leave up to you, Representative Heinzman, as to how you want to do that.
Chair. I guess I assume to hear that there's been some kind of precipitous drop in funding. That's usually what we hear when these kinds of things come up, but I'm sure there's other factors. Does there need to be, or maybe has there been a study already, and we don't have that information today, but if there hasn't been some kind of study to determine what caused this drop, I would think maybe there's an investment that needs to be made. Do we need a study to see what's going on here?
Ms. Hussein.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I would say one of the major factors is that before 2005, rates were set at the 75th percentile. So therefore, when a survey was done and the rates were tied to the 75th percentile, the available dollars simply covered more of the cost of care. So as the rates stayed frozen or sometimes decreased due to cuts at the legislature, then the rates covered simply went down because there was fewer dollars being spent per provider.
Ms. Representative Heisman.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair. So could you tell, because that's kind of what I was thinking, that you're going to tell me there was a cut. Do we know what the amount of money available per child was in 2006 versus 2018 to essentially show what a cut might have looked like from that time till now?
Ms. Posehn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure if this fully gets at this, but let me...
I can move on to another question while they're looking.
Certainly, Representative Heisman.
Okay.
And I want to... Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be more towards our other testifier anyway, so I understand we're not here today to talk about some of these other issues, but I hope that folks recognize at the agency that we absolutely have to have answers to these questions. This has got to be something that's discussed, and it's got to be discussed in a way that the public can pay attention and better understand what's going on. And so some of the things that you may anticipate in the coming weeks, I want to know, as my constituents are directing me, to know what the governor's directives are going to be in terms of bringing some change to the programs and as it relates directly to the investigation of fraud and so on and so forth. And I'd like, as I'm being told, we need to have bullet points. We need to know exactly what this administration is going to do to address this problem. Do you have any of that information, or is that something we're going to discuss later?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heinzman. And I want to say I apologize. Our understanding was we were just going to do the CCAP pieces today, so that was probably a misunderstanding on my part.
And my apologies
and
if I misunderstood.
Proper staff from OIG to address some of those questions directly. When the governor's budget was released, as Ms. Posehn said, I think it was discussed that there was a placeholder in there. We are still waiting for the auditor's report, as I know all of you are. And so we are waiting for the auditor's report to come out so that we can actually see the recommendations that the auditor has provided and see how we can address those things specifically. But we do take fraud very seriously at the department and have been working on it for quite some time and will continue to do so. And when we have more information, we will definitely provide it to you and everybody else here on this committee.
Okay. Ms. Posehn, you're answering the earlier question, I think.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure that this fully gets at this, but what I wanted to share, which is just in our forecast document, which talks about in expenditures or average costs, it doesn't break apart, though, what are the rates and what are the costs per family. In other words, costs per family are driven by age of child, what type of care they attend, how much care they get in a given week. So all those factors go into the cost per family, and the rates is a substantial part of that, but we don't have a percent of what, you know, how do you break those costs out? So as changes are made to policies, for instance, a rate freeze or increasing or decreasing the amount of care a family might qualify for in a week, those things drive the costs. But I can just share that in 2005, the average cost per family was about $790 a month. And in 2018, it was about double that, a little less than double that, or $1,430 a month. So certainly costs have gone up, but it might be more children per family. You know, there's, like I said, there might be other factors that drive that. But what we do know is that the rates were decreased twice within this time span of and haven't been increased since 2014. And we just know that based on the data that the portion that CCAP pays of what providers charge has gone down.
Okay, thank you. So Representative Heintzman, if you could keep it pretty quick and then we'll, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so the reason I was asking for a specific cost per child is because in government, cuts can mean a lot of different things. And sometimes a cut can be a cut to the inflator. And so we may actually be paying more, but we have maybe decreased the rate of growth in that appropriation. So if we could get that information, I would just personally really like to know if there was a cut, where it was, and then if we could consider a recommendation of looking at what the contributors may have been to why we're seeing this change so precipitously from 2006 to 2018, that would be helpful.
And Representative Heintzman, I want to join you in that. This is a really key point to understand, and we want as much light shown on it as possible. So, Ms. Posine, looks like you were going to have a response to that or comment on that. I may be wrong about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can bring data or share data about how the rates have changed since 2005, and when the cuts have occurred. I'm not sure, though, that gets at.
Ms. Posine, I think
all the factors.
I think if I'm understanding Representative Heintzman, and I guess my own desire as well.
Yes.
That seems like that's at least a really solid piece.
Yes.
And then more broadly, an understanding. And I know the department has the report on the status of child care. I believe it was recently released. There may be information there, et cetera. But to understand, just to understand the basics of why we're seeing this drop. Is helpful, and I'm sure that there's a series of factors that can be pointed to, but that'll just be helpful information for us to have. So thank you.
Sure.
I know we've got Representative Pryor on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to go back to something mentioned earlier in the presentation to make sure that I was understanding it, because it sounded like there's a certain amount of urgency in one of the proposals in the governor's office that the federal regulation says that we have to make sure that we're paying at least 25% of what the market rates are in a community, and that we haven't surveyed that for 4 years. And so we're so right now on this part of it, and I don't know if I'm using the correct terminology, but we're out of compliance, and that we don't have any more extensions from the federal government, and that it's by September that we need to do this. And that actually takes legislative action to be able to complete that. So if any part of that, please correct my understanding if that's wrong.
Ms. Posine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, a couple things that I will just clarify. As mentioned, in the past, the Minnesota State Legislature allowed the CCAP program to pay the 75th percentile, which is different than 75% of the rate. It's if you stack the highest rates to the lowest, you're going up 75% from the bottom. So now states are being directed to do so to the 25th percentile, which is different than 25%. And that is considered the minimum floor to avoid the penalty. We have done a survey, so that's what this proposal is tied to, is data collected from all over the state about what providers are charging, and to achieve the minimum of the 25th percentile based on the 2018 rates. And then every 3 years, we would be indexing a change based on new data.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
And thank you. Thank you for, I mean, I actually understand what we're talking about by the percentiles, but I didn't express it correctly. So I really appreciate the clarification. Thank you. So we don't, for this part, though, so then we don't, there isn't a legislative action that we need to accomplish what we need for the federal government.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm sorry if I sounded confusing about that. Yes, we would need legislative action because the rates language in current statute is tied to the 2014 changes, which were based on 2011 data. And again, it's the data that largely drives the change in percentiles that we're currently covering.
Okay.
Representative Pryor.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. So so it's really, it's a fix, essentially, is that we need to change information that we have in statute right now, and then also at that same time make it an ongoing change.
That
every 3 years, the numbers get changed, and so we won't need special legislation every 3 years to keep caught up with that.
Ms. Poussin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, correct. Our intention was to bring forward the rates language that would meet the federal conformity requirements, which are that, every 3 years and the 25th percentile being the minimum. And I will say in the federal guidance that we recently received, we also were told that states are expected to move above the 25th percentile over time, but they did not issue further guidance about what that might be.
Okay. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with bringing the rates to the federal level, there's a cost to the state for that. Do you happen to have the dollars available? And with the every 3 years, will the federal government be putting money into Minnesota to help offset that cost, or is it completely shouldered here in Minnesota?
And Ms. Poussin, I wonder if the first part of Representative Franson's question should be addressed in the change item that we should have, perhaps. But if you can, Ms. Poussin, help answer.
Yeah, I don't think we have one.
Yeah, we had it from the Department of Education. Maybe we don't from the other
so
two
that's
departments.
Why I asked.
No, yeah, I understand. Thank you. Ms. Poussin.
Representative, in answer to your, I think two parts to that question, the federal government allocated about $29 million last year and about the same increase this year to the Child Care Development Fund to help states achieve compliance, knowing in particular that rates might be the largest driver of costs. But we can use it for whatever we need for federal conformity. In the governor's proposal, we do propose in the first biennium using a little over $9 million, $9.37 million of state funds, and a little over $42.7 million in the federal money that's available to help us achieve that.
Representative Franson. Okay. Any other questions from members? Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. Sorry for any miscommunication. So we'll follow up on the items that we talked about. Encourage members to do that too. The bills that we're hearing actually relate to federal compliance. And so that's kind of a nice connection there. And so thank you very much for your presentation. And I think Representative Pryor, if you can go up, we can just do some cleanup on the one federal compliance bill. Members and the public may remember that on Thursday, Representative Heintzman had raised a concern just about the procedure for bringing one of the bills before us, and I appreciate him bringing that up. And out of an abundance of caution, we'll bring that bill back up. It's House File 1238, heard last Thursday, heard on Tuesday, pardon me, and we want to make sure to get it in front of us in the right form. And so, Representative Pryor, you are moving approval of the House File 1238 be laid over for possible inclusion in a division report. Is that correct?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Pryor, you also have an author's amendment to that bill, which you are moving as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Pryor, can you just briefly remind us, I don't know if you have it with you, but just briefly remind us about what House File 1238 is. We had a discussion last Tuesday, I guess a week and a half ago, but just to remind us.
Okay. So actually some of what's in this bill was in the presentation this morning. That the majority of it is becoming compliant with federal standards, regulations. All of the provisions in House File 1238 were included in last year's omnibus bill. It is a low cost and has been non-controversial. And much of it is required for federal conformity. And we are also one of the last states that have not conformed yet, and we are at risk right now of facing penalties.
Okay, and again, we had had a discussion on it on Tuesday the 19th. Any further discussion, members? And then hearing none, pardon me, I guess it's being laid over, isn't it? pardon me. A lot going on this week. But we do have to vote on the A1 amendment. Thank you. So all in favor of approval of the author's A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. There we go. So the bill is amended, and we have it laid over. And so thank you very much, Representative Pryor. And with that, I'm going to go up front and turn things over to our vice chair.
Members, we have HF 1230 up for consideration today. So, Chair Pinto, you are intending to lay over HF 1230 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Correct. Yes, possible inclusion in division report, Madam Chair.
So moved. We have the bill before us. Members, our author has an amendment labeled A1 to get the bill in the shape he would like to hear it. Chair Pinto, would you like to move your author's amendment, Title A1?
Madam Chair, I will move the A1 amendment to House File 1230.
Chair Pinto moves amendment. Please speak to that amendment.
Maybe I'll just describe that House File 1230 includes language that passed House last year and was included in the I forget the Senate file. I'm not going to use the phrase, Representative Heinzman, you didn't want me to use to describe it. But there was a bill that got vetoed at the end of the session last time. This language was included in that. I believe it was Department of Education, reviewed the language, they had a suggestion to clarify an item here having to do with a child who's in need of protective services or in foster care, so child in the child welfare system. And so thought that this would be clarifying language that would be helpful. And so that's the explanation for the amendment, Madam Chair.
Chair Pinto, thanks for explaining that. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now that the bill is in the shape the author intends, we can proceed with testimony. Chair Pinto, do you have testifiers today?
I do, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'll just, and as they come up, I'll just again confirm that the purpose of this language that, again, was included previously, passed the House previously, was to make sure that that vulnerable children and families, children experiencing homelessness, those in foster care, need protective services, that they can easily access their early learning scholarships. It also creates an additional region by splitting the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul, into their own region, but it doesn't impact other regions of the state and ensures equity for low-income students within the two cities. And then there's just some cleanup language, et cetera, and my testifiers, I think, can help describe a little more about that. So if I can call up my first testifier, I believe maybe from the Department of Education. I'm not sure who is going to be. Oh, there we go. Thanks, Ms. Snyder.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
The Department of Education. Everything that's in front of the committee at this time was carried in the MDE policy or budget bill last year. The first section just clarifies that the screening tools that are provided to students should be age-appropriate versions of the screening tools. Section 2 removes some obsolete language that is no longer required because we are past these fiscal years. It separates Minneapolis and St. Paul into two distinct buckets for voluntary pre-K. Section 3 is more substantive. It clarifies that students that are designated in need of protective services or experiencing homelessness or housing instability should not be required to submit income eligibility for early learning scholarships. So if you're experiencing some of these situations, you might not have your tax returns available to be immediately qualified. So this gives these families a little bit more flexibility in times of need. Section 4 is, again, just some clarifying language that says some students are able to access early learning scholarships before age 3. The screening tools that are available are really more appropriate for at age 3. So this is saying that a student who receives a scholarship does not need to receive that screening until after their third birthday. And then Section 5 is just removing an obsolete reference that was included in statute for the early learning pilot sites before they were rated via Parent Aware to make sure that they were eligible for early learning scholarships. This is no longer a concern because the pilot sites are already Parent Aware rated.
Okay. And I have a couple of other brief testifiers, I believe. Ms. Stunkel?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kristen Stunkel. I'm the Director of Community Education and Communications for Columbia Heights Public Schools. This morning, I'm representing the Minnesota Community Education Association that serves Minnesotans of every age throughout the state, and I want to thank Representative Pinto and the committee for their work in this area. We support parent choice and student access to safe, healthy, and high-quality early childhood education and care through programs such as voluntary pre-kindergarten, School Readiness Plus, and the Early Learning Scholarships of Pathways 1 and 2. School-based programs offer parents another choice in free, high-quality preschool and to prepare four-year-olds in the greatest poverty for success in kindergarten. We appreciate your understanding that these young scholars deserve the best start in their academic development, and we support the provisions in current law that applications must be ordered by rank using a sliding scale based on criteria that first centers on the concentration of kindergarten students eligible for free and reduced lunches at the school sites. This gives priority to high-poverty schools. Columbia Heights Public Schools received funding to serve 144 four-year-olds in our VPK program at each of our elementaries, total 144. Every school in our district has above 75% free and reduced lunch rate. And with voluntary pre-kindergarten, we are serving exactly the students who would fall into the achievement gap prior to kindergarten. Our full-day program is only available to students who qualify for free and reduced lunch and live within the district, within the boundaries of that school. For families in our district and other districts receiving VPK, these are the benefits. Free pre-kindergarten programming for four-year-olds who live in poverty. So we eliminated the low fee that we had been charging prior to the VPK funding. Alignment in curriculum, instruction, and assessment with our Early Childhood Family Education Program, ECFE, pre-K-3, and kindergarten for a continuity of developmentally appropriate education. All classrooms are integrated with students served by early childhood special education and English language learners. Transportation to and from school, participation in breakfast and lunch programs, access to not only the school social workers, but also specialist classes and other school-based supports for students and families. access also to our home visiting by our ECFE parent educator, who has a teaching license as a parent educator with understanding of child development and guidance and also parent development and concerns, and coordination with district and local child care providers for wraparound care. We also support the changes to prioritize early learning scholarships for families who are homeless, in protective services or foster care. We work with our local county services to reach out to families experiencing homelessness and to students served by foster care and other communities, county services. While this is in another bill, I did want to add that ensuring funding for the VPK School Readiness Plus and scholarships will enable districts and child care partners to continue to provide high-quality early childhood education that parents are choosing for their children. The development of our young Minnesota scholars and of our future workforce is based on access to high-quality education. Thank you for supporting the continuation of these important programs for Minnesota families and communities. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. And then just one more testifier very briefly, Madam Chair. So Ms. Erickson.
Ms. Erickson. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, I'm a former kindergarten teacher, so just be ready for some explosion here. My name is Lori Erickson. I'm very proud to represent the St. Paul Public Schools pre-kindergarten program, where we serve 1,900 children. That's incredible. And we are deeply thankful for the funding that has been provided over the past several years. We offer half and full-day pre-kindergarten programming. Within 90 days of entry, all of our children have access to early childhood screening. Within any one of our given programs, you will see pathway scholarship funding, voluntary pre-K funding, grant funding, local referendum funding. We are a model for blending, braiding, and layering funding. Much like Columbia Heights, we have free transportation, free lunch, free breakfast. We have three priority points within our enrollment. We are prioritizing free and reduced lunch, special education students, and second language learners. And I believe you do have the one pager in front of you, and you can see the growth over time of the students that we are serving. And although you do not see it on the sheet, we do have internal processes for our homeless and highly mobile children. Currently within our program, roughly 10% of our currently enrolled students are experiencing homelessness. We have internal procedures to make certain that transportation is provided no matter where they are. We are also working with our Project Reach staff to identify children that may come up through the system, and we have processes in place to make sure that our students that are homeless are getting a spot within our program. Much like Columbia Heights, our program is free. We are serving the children we need to serve in St. Paul. And as you can see on our one-pager, all of our teachers have a degree and a license from the state of Minnesota. There's instructional coaching for our teachers as well as our principals. We are very fortunate. As you can see, the achievement is showing we're making a difference. Much of what we're doing in pre-kindergarten is being pushed up into kindergarten, which we are so thankful for. Within our program, we have something called Discovering Our World, which is a locally grown program that is rooted in social-emotional readiness. Everything that we do is teaching children how to self-regulate. And as an added bonus, literacy, math, science, social studies, all of that is coming through that social-emotional readiness. Currently, we serve about 1,900 children. Within the city of St. Paul, there are 4,000 students. We simply can't serve them all. We do not have the facility space. So it is incumbent upon us to partner with various agencies. And you have another one-pager. St. Paul loves doing one-pagers. You can see we are partnering with 13 different child cares. And I believe some of you visited St. Paul Music Academy. Not in this group, but another group of legislators had the absolute privilege of going to St. Paul Music Academy. Right currently, there are two classrooms. There are two full-day classrooms, 40 children. Our wait list is 53 children are waiting to get into that school right now. And knowing that, just right up the street is New Horizon. We partner with the preschool classroom at that New Horizon Center to ensure that those children are getting the social-emotional supports that they may need, the teachers, the directors, whatever the case may be, and ensure that those children end up in a kindergarten placement. I don't get to talk more. please, we are deeply thankful for the funding that we have, and invite you to come and see us at any point in time. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Erickson. I was actually supposed to attend the St. Paul Music Academy tour yesterday, but I had a rough morning with my 2-, 3-, and 5-year-old, so I missed the tour, unfortunately. I look forward to it in the future.
Early childhood, Madam Chair.
Do we have any questions either for the testifiers or for Chair Pinto from the committee members? And is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify? Chair Pinto, do you have any last words on your bill?
No, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for your patience with all of us.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. HF 1230, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just make a couple logistical comments, which maybe I'll just do from here to members. A reminder that we have a hearing tomorrow in St. Cloud. We had canceled the hearing on Tuesday this week, in part because we're going to have two hearings this week. I do want to make sure to lay out a couple details. I've received messages from some folks expressing concern about the location and et cetera regarding the hearing. Just a reminder to really everyone that our over time, especially this session, we've been having field hearings in a number of places around the state. So the Health and Human Services Policy Committee was in Onamia and Mille Lacs. The Education and Finance was in Windham. Transportation Committee was in St. Cloud, and actually then in North Minneapolis last night, I guess 2 nights ago. And this is a joint hearing with the Jobs Committee. It certainly will be recorded, of course, as is required. Not all of our hearings are broadcast live. This one, I believe, we're setting up so it will actually be available via there'll actually be a Facebook Live feed. I believe we're setting that up, but through my own legislative page, but then certainly recorded as well. So certainly welcome folks watching from there. The theme is economic development, because we are doing this with the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. Members, you should be pretty set in terms of logistics, in terms of getting there, et cetera, but any questions or concerns, contact our committee administrator. And then finally, just a note that we'll be moving into a probably higher level of activity in the next few weeks, so we're pushing towards deadlines, et cetera. And so keep in touch. We'll send out information about additional times we'll be meeting, and just have to blend that with other committees as well. And I thank you, members and public, for your involvement. So, and with that, Madam Chair, I have nothing else, and would welcome you to adjourn if that seems appropriate.
Representative Franson.
Mr. Chair, perhaps you can help clarify something. A few members of the public have asked me, and I've kind of wondered myself, in various committees, and this has happened as well, it's referred to as, possible, laid over for possible inclusion to an omnibus bill, and then it's quickly corrected to committee report. I noticed that you said this same thing, and then in the script it must say omnibus bill. But could you please tell us, I know that it was a big deal about getting rid of the omnibus bills. That was a big discussion. No more omnibus bills. We're going to do single bills. So what is the difference between a committee report in an omnibus bill?
Thank
you. Division report.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Franson. Thank you so much for asking that, because I know it can get confusing for all of us, certainly for folks watching in. So we are a division of two committees. And so my first term, I served on the property tax division of the full taxes committee. And so our committee, which is really a division, met for the whole whole session. Representative Drozdowski was the chair. And then we produced a division report that went up to the taxes committee. And the provisions that our committee looked at all went to this bill. There were a few things that got sent along other places, if they happened to touch property tax committee, but went someplace else. But then most of the provisions that we heard ended up being laid over for possible inclusion in a division report, this bill that then went up to our parent committee and property taxes, Representative Drozdowski's committee back then. Our committee is a division of two committees, so we're going to have two division reports. There's been, I think for many of us, there's just this habit of using this phrase. I think we've heard this in many committees, and I suspect probably in even some of the finance committees we all serve on, people are still saying that phrase of omnibus bill. But really what it is it's a division report that's going up to the committee that each of these committees is a part of. So we report to Education Finance, HHS Finance, so we produce a division report that goes up to those committees. But I think it's sort of like the bill that with the name that we shall not use, Service Enhancement, the Omnibus Prime, that sort of people have this this sort of comfortable language they use. They toss out, oh, well, possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. What it is really is it's a division report. And so that's the distinction, if that's helpful.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you. So when it leaves Ways and Means, is it still a division report or does it become an omnibus bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. So each of these things is a bill. It will be my understanding is that bills will leave Ways and Means as bills that go to the floor, and they'll contain whatever they contain. I'm not on Ways and Means, so I want to be careful for speaking on behalf of anybody over there. But my understanding, there wouldn't be a division report at that point because Ways and Means is not itself a division of anything else. So, but as far as our committee is concerned, it's a division report that goes up, if that's helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So it sounds like then once it gets leaves Ways and Means, then it becomes an omnibus bill or omnibus prime. So thank you for that.
I guess personally I would like to clarify, I think there's a difference between a typical omnibus bill and what is being referred to as omnibus prime, which was longer than the first three Harry Potter books combined last year. Perhaps somebody else can clarify. Chair Pinto, I don't know if that's typical length.
Well, I would definitely say, Madam Chair, much worse reading than those first three books. That is for sure. So regardless of what adjective we apply to the word bill, omnibus bill, bad bill, good bill, whatever we use, they're all bills. And then we discuss, as we've discussed before, things have to relate to a single subject. The Supreme Court has interpreted that in ways relating to a general topic, et cetera, and get into that. But in any case, it is not a division report when it leaves Ways and Means. It is a bill. And then how we describe that bill, we'll probably have that discussion on the floor and otherwise, Representative Franzen. So, yeah, thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair. And thanks for raising that, for clarifying that.
Thank you.
So
just to clarify, for tomorrow morning, our bus is going to leave the state office building on the Capitol side, so the street to the east, at 10 a.m. sharp. I look forward to seeing everybody there. With that, this meeting is adjourned.
Good. Thank you.